the medicals, when the time came, would access the defector's history. Simultaneously, the procedures they carried out in the pod would be fed back to the Sony and collated, ready for Ramirez to ice them and shift them out into cyberspace, where Jaylene's slide would be riding shotgun from her seat in the oil rig. If it all went smoothly, the medical update would be waiting in Hosaka's Mexico City compound when Turner brought him in the jet. Turner had never seen anything quite like the Sony, but he supposed the Dutchman would have had something very similar in his Singapore clinic. The thought brought his hand to his bare chest, where he unconsciously traced the vanished line of a graft scar. The second table supported the cyberspace gear. The deck was identical with the one he'd seen on the oil rig, a Moss Neotech prototype. The deck configuration was standard, but Conroy had said that it was built up from the new biochips. There was a fist-sized lump of pale pink plastique squashed on top of the console. Someone, perhaps Ramirez, had thumbed in twin depressions for eyes and a crude curve of idiot grin. Two wires, one blue, the other yellow, ran from the thing's pink forehead to one of the black gaping tubes that protruded from the wall behind the console. Another of Weber's chores, if there seemed any danger of the site being overrun. Turner eyed the wires, frowning. A charge that size, in that small enclosed space, guaranteed death for anyone in the bunker. His shoulders aching, the back of his head brushing the rough concrete of the ceiling, he continued his inspection. The rest of the table was taken up with the deck's peripherals, a series of black boxes positioned with obsessive precision. He suspected that each unit was a certain specific distance from its neighbor, and they were perfectly aligned. Ramirez himself would have set them out, and Turner was certain that if he touched one, moved at the least fraction, the jockey would know. He'd seen that same neurotic touch before in other console men, and it told him nothing about Ramirez. He'd watched other jockeys who reversed the trait, deliberately tangling their gear in a rat's nest of leads and cables, who were terrified of tidiness and plastered their consoles with decals of dice and screaming skulls. There was no way to tell, he thought. Either Ramirez was good, or else they all might be dead soon. At the far end of the table were five Telefunken earbead transceivers with adhesive throat mics, still sealed in individual bubble packs. During the crucial phase of the defection, which Turner took to be the 20 minutes of either side of Mitchell's arrival, he, Ramirez, Sutcliffe, Weber, and Lynch would be linked. Although the use of the transceivers was to be kept to an absolute minimum. Behind the Telefunkens was an unmarked plastic carton that contained 20 Swedish catalytic hand warmers, smooth flat oblongs of stainless steel, each in its own drawstring bag of Christmas red flannelette. "You're a clever bastard," he said to the carton. "I might have thought that one up myself." He slept on a corrugated foam hiker's pad on the floor of the command post, using the park as a blanket. Conroy had been right about the desert night, but the concrete seemed to hold the day's heat. He left his fatigues and shoes on. Weber had advised him to shake his shoes and clothing out whenever he dressed. "Scorpions," she'd say. "They like sweat, any kind of moisture." He removed the Smith & Wesson from the nylon holster before he lay down, carefully positioning it beside the foam pad. He left the two battery lanterns on and closed his eyes, and slid into a shallow sea of dream, images tossing past, fragments of Mitchell's dossier melding with bits of his own life. He and Mitchell drove a bus through a cascade of plate glass into the lobby of a Marrakesh hotel. The scientist whooped as he pressed the button that detonated the 24 canisters of CN taped along the flanks of the vehicle, and Oki was there too, offering him whiskey from a bottle and yellow Peruvian cocaine on a round, plastic-rimmed mirror he'd last seen in Allison's purse. He thought he saw Allison somewhere beyond the windows of the bus, choking in the clouds of gas, and he tried to tell Oki, tried to point her out, but the glass was plastered with Mexican holograms of saints, postcards of the Virgin, and Oki was holding up something smooth and round, a globe of pink crystal, and he saw a spider crouched at its core, a spider made of quicksilver. But Mitchell was laughing, his teeth full of blood, and extending his open palm to offer Turner the gray biosoft. Turner saw that the dossier was a brain, grayish pink and alive beneath a wet clear membrane, pulsing softly in Mitchell's hand. And then he tumbled over some submarine ledge of dream and settled smoothly down into a night with no stars at all. Weber woke him, her hard features framed in the square doorway, her shoulders draped in the heavy military blanket taped across the entrance. "Got your 3 hours. The medicals are up if you want to talk to him." She withdrew, her boots crunching gravel. Hosaka's medics were waiting beside the self-contained neurosurgery. Under a desert dawn, they looked as though they'd just stepped from some kind of matter transmitter in their fashionably rumpled Ginza casuals. One of the men was bundled in an oversized Mexican hand-knit, the sort of belted cardigan Turner had seen tourists wear in Mexico City. The other two wore expensive-looking insulated ski jackets against the desert cold. The men were a head shorter than the Korean, a slender woman with strong archaic features and a bird-like ruff of red-tinged hair that made Turner think of raptors. Conroy had said that the two were company men, and Turner could see it easily. Only the woman had the attitude, the stance that belonged to Turner's world, and she was an outlaw, a black medic. She'd be right at home with the Dutchman, he thought. "I'm Turner," he said. "I'm in charge here."
"You don't need our names,"
the woman said as the two Hosaka men bowed automatically. They exchanged glances, looked at Turner, then looked back to the Korean. "No," Turner said. "It isn't necessary."
"Why are we still denied access to the patient's medical data?"
the Korean asked. "Security," Turner said, the answer very nearly an automatic response. In fact, he could see no reason to prevent them from studying Mitchell's records. The woman shrugged, turned away, her face hidden by the upturned collar of her insulated jacket.
"Would you like to inspect the surgery?"
the man in the bulky cardigan asked, his face polite and alert, a perfect corporate mask. "No," Turner said. "We'll be moving you out to the lot 20 minutes prior to his arrival. We'll take the wheels off, level you with Jax. The sewage link will be disconnected. I want you fully operational 5 minutes after we set you down."
"There will be no problem,"
the other man said, smiling. "Now I want you to tell me what you're going to be doing in there, what you'll do to him and how it might affect him."
"You don't know?"
the woman asked sharply, turning back to face him. "I said that I wanted you to tell me," Turner said.
"We'll conduct an immediate scan for lethal implants,"
the man in the cardigan said. "Cortex charges, that sort of thing?"
"I doubt," said the other man, "that we will encounter anything so crude, but yes, we will be scanning for the full range of lethal devices. Simultaneously, we'll run a full blood screen. We understand that his current employers deal in extremely sophisticated biochemical systems. It would seem possible that the greatest danger would lie in that direction. It's currently quite fashionable to equip top employees with modified insulin pump subdermals."
His partner broke in.
"The subject system can be tricked into an artificial reliance on certain synthetic enzyme analogs. Unless the subdermal is recharged at regular intervals, withdrawal from the source, the employer, can result in trauma." "We are prepared to deal with that as well," said the other. Neither of you are even remotely prepared to deal with what I suspect we will encounter.
The black medic said, her voice as cold as the wind that blew out of the east now. Turner heard sand hissing across the rusted sheet of steel above them.
You,
Turner said to her,
come with me.
Then he turned, without looking back, and walked away. It was possible that she might not obey his command, in which case he'd lose face with the other two, but it seemed the right move. When he was 10 meters from the surgery pod, he halted. He heard her feet in the gravel.
What do you know?
He asked without turning.
Perhaps no more than you do, she said. Perhaps more.
More than your colleagues, obviously.
They are extremely talented men. They are also servants.
And you are not.
Neither are you, mercenary. I was hired out of the finest unlicensed clinic in Chiba for this. I was given a great deal of material to study in preparation for my meeting with this illustrious patient. The black clinics of Chiba are the cutting edge of medicine. Not even Hosaka could know that my position in black medicine would allow me to guess what it is that your defector carries in his head. The street tries to find its own uses for things, Mr. Turner. Already several times I've been hired to attempt the removal of these new implants. A certain amount of advanced mass biocircuitry has found its way into the market. These attempts at implanting are a logical step. I suspect Mars may leak these things deliberately.
Then explain it to me.
I don't think I could, she said, and there was a strange hint of resignation in her voice. I told you I've seen it. I didn't say that I understood it.
Fingertips suddenly brushed the skin beside his skulljack.
This, compared with biochip implants, is like a wooden staff beside a myoelectric limb.
But will it be life-threatening in his case?
Oh, no, she said, withdrawing her hand. Not for him.
And then he heard her trudging back toward the surgery. Conroy sent a runner in with a software package that would allow Turner to pilot the jet that would carry Mitchell to Hosaka's Mexico City compound. The runner was a wild-eyed, sun-blackened man Lynch called Harry, a rope-muscled apparition who came cycling in from the direction of Tucson on a sand-scoured bike with balding lug tires and bone-yellow rawhide laced around its handlebars. Lynch led Harry across the parking lot. Harry was singing to himself, a strange sound in the enforced quiet of the site. And his song, if you could call it that, was like someone randomly tuning a broken radio up and down midnight miles of dial, bringing in gospel shouts and snatches of 20 years of international pop. Harry had his bike slung across one burnt, bird-thin shoulder.
Harry's got something for you from Tucson, Lynch said.
You two know each other?
Turner asked, looking at Lynch.
Maybe have a friend in common?
What's that supposed to mean?
Lynch asked. Turner held a stare.
You know his name?
He told me his fucking name, Turner.
Name's Harry,
the burnt man said. He tossed the bicycle down on a clump of brush.
He smiled vacantly, exposing badly spaced eroded teeth.
His bare chest was filmed with sweat and dust and hung with loops of fine steel chain, rawhide, bits of animal horn and fur, brass cartridge casings, copper coins worn smooth and faceless with use, and a small pouch made of soft brown leather. Turner looked at the assortment of things strung across the skinny chest and reached out, flipping a crooked bit of bent gristle suspended from a length of braided string.
What the hell is that, Harry?
That's a coon's pecker,
Harry said.
Coon's got him a jointed bone in his pecker. Not many as know that.
You ever meet my friend Lynch before, Harry? Harry blinked.
He had the passwords. Lynch said, there's an urgency hierarchy. He knew the top. He told me his name. Do you need me here, or can I get back to work?
Go, Turner said.
When Lynch was out of earshot, Harry began to work at the thongs that sealed the leather pouch.
You shouldn't be harsh with the boy, he said. He's really very good. I actually didn't see him until he had that Fletcher up against my neck.
He opened the pouch and fished delicately inside.
Tell Conroy I've got him pegged.
Sorry?
Harry said, extracting a folded sheet of yellow notebook paper from his pouch.
You've got who pegged?
He handed it to Turner. There was something inside.
Lynch.
He's Conroy's bum boy on the site, tell him. He unfolded the paper and removed the fat military Microsoft. There was a note in blue capitals. Break a leg, asshole. See you in the DF.
Do you really want me to tell him that?
Tell him.
You're the boss.
You fucking know it.
Turner said, crumpling the paper and thrusting it into Harry's left armpit.
Harry smiled, sweetly and vacantly, and the intelligence that had risen in him settled again like some aquatic beast sinking effortlessly down into a smooth sea of sun-addled vapidity. Turner stared into his eyes, cracked yellow opal, and saw nothing there but sun and the broken highway. A hand with missing joints came up to scratch absently at a week's growth of beard.
Now, Turner said.
Harry turned, pulled his bike up from the tangle of brush, shouldered it with a grunt, and began to make his way back across the ruined parking lot. His oversized, tattered khaki shorts flapped as he went, and his collection of chains rattled softly. Sutcliffe whistled from a rise 20 meters away, held up a roll of orange surveyor's tape. It was time to start laying out Mitchell's landing strip. They'd have to work quickly, before the sun was too high. And still, it was going to be hot.
So, Weber said, he's coming in by air.
She spat brown juice on a yellowed cactus. Her cheek was packed with Copenhagen snuff.
You got it,
Turner said. He sat beside her, on a ledge of buff shale. They were watching Lynch and Nathan clear the strip he and Sutcliffe had laid out with the orange tape. The tape marked out a rectangle 4 meters wide and 20 long. Lynch carried a length of rusted I-beam to the tape and heaved it over. Something scurried away through the brush as the beam rang on concrete.
They can see that tape if they want to, Weber said, wiping her lips with the back of her hand. Read the headlines on your morning fax if they want to.
I know, Turner said. But if they don't know we're here already, I don't think they're going to. And you couldn't see it from the highway.
He adjusted the black nylon cap Ramirez had given him, pulling the long bill down until it touched his sunglasses.
Anyway, we're just moving the heavy stuff, the things that could tear a leg off. It isn't going to look like anything. Not from orbit.
No,
Weber agreed, her seamed face impassive beneath her sunglasses. He could smell her sweat from where she sat. Sharp. And animal.
What the hell do you do, Weber, when you aren't doing this?
He looked at her.
Probably a hell of a lot more than you do,
she said.
Part of the time I breed dogs.
She took a knife from her boot and began to strop it patiently on her sole, flipping it smoothly with each stroke, like a Mexican barber sharpening a razor.
And I fish. Trout.
You have people in New Mexico?
Probably more than you've got,
she said flatly.
I figure the ones like you and Sutcliffe. You aren't from any place at all. This is where you live, isn't it, Turner? On the site, today. The day your boy comes out, right?
She tested the blade against the ball of her thumb, then slid it back into its sheath.
But you have people. You got a man to go back to?
A woman, you want to know, she said. Know anything about breeding dogs?
No, he said.
I didn't think so.
She squinted at him.
We got a kid, too. Ours. She carried it.
DNA splice?
She nodded.
That's expensive, he said.
You know it. Wouldn't be here if we didn't need to pay it off. But she's beautiful.
Your woman?
Our kid.
Chapter 12 Café Blanc. As she walked from the Louvre, she seemed to sense some articulated structure shifting to accommodate her course through the city. The waiter would be merely a part of the thing, one limb, a delicate probe or palp. The whole would be larger, much larger. How could she have imagined that it would be possible to live, to move in the unnatural field of Viereck's wealth without suffering distortion? Viereck had taken her up in all her misery and had rotated her through the monstrous, invisible stresses of his money. And she had been changed. Of course, she thought, of course. It moves around me constantly, watchful and invisible. The vast and subtle mechanism of Herr Viereck's surveillance. Eventually she found herself on the pavement below the terrace of the Blanc. It seemed as good a place as any. A month before, she would have avoided it. She'd spent too many evenings with Alan there. Now, feeling that she had been freed, she decided to begin the process of rediscovering her own Paris by choosing a table at the Blanc. She took one near a side screen. She asked a waiter for a cognac and shivered, watching the Paris traffic flow past, perpetual river of steel and glass, while all around her at other tables, strangers ate and smiled, drank and argued, said bitter goodbyes, or swore private fealties to an afternoon's feeling. But, she smiled, she was a part of it all. Something in her was waking from a long and stifled sleep, brought back into the light in the instant she'd fully opened her eyes to Alan's viciousness and her own desperate need to continue loving him. But that need was fading, even as she sat here. The shabbiness of his lies somehow had broken the chains of her depression. She could see no logic to it because she had known in some part of herself, and long before the business with Nas, exactly what it was that Alan did in the world, and that had made no difference to her love. In the face of this new feeling, however, she would forego logic. It was enough to be here, alive, at a table in the Blanc, and to imagine all around her the intricate machine that she now knew Viereck had deployed. Ironies, she thought, seeing the young waiter from Napoleon Court step up onto the terrace. He wore the dark trousers he had worked in, but the apron had been replaced with a blue windbreaker. Dark hair fell across his forehead in a smooth wing. He came toward her, smiling, confident, knowing that she wouldn't run.
There was something in her then that wanted very badly to run. But she knew that she wouldn't. Irony, she told herself. As I luxuriate in the discovery that I am no special sponge for sorrow, but merely another fallible animal in the stone maze of a city, I come simultaneously to see that I am the focus of some vast device fueled by an obscure desire. My name is Baku, he said, pulling out the white-painted iron chair opposite her own. You were the child. The boy in the park.
A long time ago, yes, he said. Tanyor has preserved the image of my childhood.
I have been thinking about your Tanyor.
She didn't look at him, but at the passing cars, cooling her eyes in the flow of traffic, the colors of polycarbon and painted steel.
A man like Virek is incapable of divesting himself of his wealth. His money has a life of its own, perhaps a will of its own. He implied as much when we met.
You are a philosopher.
I'm a tool, Paco.
I'm the most recent tip for a very old machine in the hands of a very old man who wishes to penetrate something and has so far failed to do so. Your employer fumbles through a thousand tools and somehow chooses me.
You are a poet as well.
She laughed, taking her eyes from the traffic. He was grinning, his mouth bracketed in deep vertical grooves.
While I walked here, I imagined a structure, a machine so large that I am incapable of seeing it. A machine that surrounds me, anticipating my every step.
And you are an egotist as well.
Am I?
Perhaps not. Certainly you are observed. We watch, and it is well that we do. Your friend in the brasserie, we watch him as well. Unfortunately, we've been unable to determine where he obtained the hologram he showed you. Very likely, he already had it when he began to phone your friend's number. Someone got to him, do you understand? Someone has put him in your way. Don't you think that this is most intriguing? Doesn't it pique the philosopher in you?
Yes, I suppose it does. I took the advice you gave me in the brasserie and agreed to his price.
Then he will double it.
Paco smiled.
Which is of no importance to me, as you pointed out. He has agreed to contact me tomorrow. I assume that you can arrange the delivery of money. He asked for cash.
Cash, he rolled his eyes. How risque. But yes, I can. And I know the details as well. We were monitoring the conversation. Not difficult, as he was helpful enough to broadcast it himself from a bead microphone. We were anxious to learn who that broadcast was intended for, but we doubt he knows that himself.
It was unlike him, she said, frowning, to excuse himself to break off that way before he had made his demands. He fancies he has a flair for the dramatic moment.
He had no choice, Paco said. We engineered what he took to be a failure of the bead's power source. It required a trip to the Ohm then. He said very nasty things about you, alone in the cubicle.
She gestured to her empty glass as a waiter passed.
I still find it difficult to see my part in this. My value. To Virek, I mean.
Don't ask me. You are the philosopher here. I merely execute Tenor's orders, to the best of my ability.
Would you like a brandy, Paco? Or perhaps some coffee?
The French,
he said with great conviction.
Know nothing about coffee.
Chapter 13. With both hands.
Maybe you can run that one by me again, Bobby said, around a mouthful of rice and eggs.
I thought you already said it's not a religion.
Beauvoir removed his eyeglass frames and sighted down one of the earpieces.
That wasn't what I said. I said, you didn't have to worry about it at all, whether it's a religion or not. It's just a structure. Let's you and me discuss some things that are happening, otherwise we might not have words for it. Concepts.
But you talk like these, what you call them, lows are
lo-a.
Beauvoir corrected, tossing his glasses down on the table. He sighed, dug one of the Chinese cigarettes from Two-A-Day's pack, and lit it with the pewter skull.
Plural's same as the singular.
He inhaled deeply, blew out twin streams of smoke through arched nostrils.
You think religion. What are you thinking about exactly?
Well, my mother's sister, she's a Scientologist, real orthodox, you know. And there's this woman across the hall, she's Catholic. My old lady, he paused, the food gone tasteless in his mouth. She'd put these holograms up in my room sometimes, Jesus or Hubbard or some shit. I guess I think about that.
Vodou isn't like that, Beauvoir said. It isn't concerned with notions of salvation and transcendence. What it's about is getting things done. You follow me? In our system, there are many gods, spirits, part of one big family with all the virtues, all the vices. There's a ritual tradition of communal manifestation, understand? Vodou says there's God, sure, Grand Maître, but he's big and too far away to worry himself if your ass is poor or you can't get laid. Come on, man, you know how this works. It's street religion, came out of a dirt-poor place a million years ago. Vodou's like the street. Some duster chops out your sister, you don't go camp on the Yakuza's doorstep, do you? No way. You go to somebody, though, who can get the thing done right. Bobby nodded, chewing thoughtfully. Another derm and two glasses of red wine had helped a lot, and the big man had taken Two-A-Day for a walk through the trees and the fluorescent jackstraws, leaving Bobby with Beauvoir. Then Jackie had shown up all cheerful, with a big bowl of this eggs and rice stuff, which wasn't bad at all. And as she'd put it down on the table in front of him, she'd pressed one of her tits against his shoulder.
So, Beauvoir said, we are concerned with getting things done. If you want, we're concerned with systems. And so are you. Or at least you want to be. Or else you wouldn't be a cowboy, and you wouldn't have a handle, right?
He dunked what was left of the cigarette in a fingerprinted glass half full of red wine.
Looks like Two-A-Day was about to get down to serious partying about the time the shit hit the fan.
What shit's that?
Bobby asked, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand.
You, Beauvoir said, frowning. Not that any of it is your fault. As much as Two-A-Day wants to make out, that's the case.
He does? He seems pretty tense now, real bitchy, too.
Exactly. You got it.
Tense.
Scared shitless is more like it.
So, how come?
Well, you see, things aren't exactly what they seem with Two-A-Day. I mean, yeah, he actually does the kind of shit you've known him to. Hustles hot software to the Caspers, pardon me. He grinned. Down in Barrytown. But his main shot, I mean, the man's real ambitions, you understand, lie elsewhere.
Beauvoir picked up a wilted canapé,
regarded it with evident suspicion, and flicked it over the table into the trees.
His thing, you understand, is dicking around for a couple of big-time sprawl Ungans.
Bobby nodded blankly.
Dudes who serve with both hands.
You lost me there.
We're talking the professional priesthood here, you want to call it that. Otherwise, just imagine a couple of major dudes, consul cowboys, among other things, who make it their business to get things done for people. To serve with both hands is an expression we have, sort of means they work both ends, white and black, got me?
Bobby swallowed, then shook his head.
Sorcerers, Beauvoir said. Never mind. Bad dudes. Big money, that's all you need to know. Two a day, he acts like an upline Joe boy for these people. Sometimes he finds something they might be interested in. He downloads it on them, collects a few favors later. Maybe he collects a dozen too many favors, they download something on him. Not quite the same proposition, you follow me? Say they get something they think has potential, but it scares them. These characters tend to a certain conservatism, you see. No? Well, you learn.
Bobby nodded.
The kind of software someone like you would rent from Two a Day, that's nothing. I mean, it'll work, but it's nothing anybody heavy would ever bother with. You've seen a lot of cowboy kinos, right? Well, the stuff they make up for those things isn't much compared with the kind of shit a real heavy operator can front, particularly when it comes to icebreakers. Heavy icebreakers are kind of funny to deal in, even for the big boys. You know why? Because ice, all the really hard stuff, the walls around every major store of data in the Matrix is always the produce of an AI, an artificial intelligence. Nothing else is fast enough to weave good ice and constantly alter and upgrade it. So, when a really powerful icebreaker shows up on the black market, there are already a couple of very dicey factors in play. Like for starts, where did the product come from? 9 times out of 10, it came from an AI. And AIs are constantly screened, mainly by the Turing people, to make sure they don't get too smart. So maybe you'll get the Turing machine after your ass, because maybe an AI somewhere wants to augment its private cash flow. Some AIs have citizenship, right? Another thing you have to watch out for. Maybe it's a military icebreaker, and that's bad heat, too. Or maybe it's taken a walk out of some Zaibatsu's industrial espionage arm, and you don't want that either. You taking the shit in, Bobby?
Bobby nodded. He felt like he'd been waiting all his life to hear Beauvoir explain the workings of a world whose existence he'd only guessed at before.
Still, an icebreaker that'll really cut is worth mega. I mean, beaucoup. So maybe you're Mr. Big in the market. Someone offers you this thing, and you don't want to just tell him to take a walk, so you buy it. You buy it real quiet, but you don't slot it. No. What do you do with it? You take it home, have your tech fix it up so it looks real average, like you have it set up in a format like this.
And he tapped a stack of software in front of him.
And you take it to your Joe boy, who owes you some favors, as usual.
Wait a sec, Bobby said. I don't think I like.
Good. That means you're getting smart, or anyway smarter. Because that's what they did. They brought it out here to your friendly wareman, Mr. Two-a-Day, and they told him their problem. Ace, they say, we want to check this shit out. Test drive it, but no way we gonna do it ourselves. It's down to you, boy. So, in the way of things, what's Two-A-Day gonna do with it? Is he gonna slot it? No way at all. He just does the same damn thing the big boys did to him, except he isn't even gonna bother telling the guy he's going to do it to. What he does, he picks a base out in the Midwest that's full of tax dodge programs and yen laundry flowcharts for some whorehouse in Kansas City, and everybody who didn't just fall off a tree knows that the motherfucker is eyeball deep in ice. Black ice. Totally lethal feedback programs. There isn't a cowboy in the sprawl or out who'd mess with that base. First, because it's dripping with defenses. Second, because the stuff inside isn't worth anything to anybody but the IRS, and they're probably already on the owner's take. Hey, Bobby said, let me get this straight. I'm giving it to you straight, white boy. He picked out that base. Then he ran down his list of hot doggers, ambitious punks from over in Barrytown, Wilsons dumb enough to run a program they'd never seen before, against a base that some joker like Two-A-Day fingered for them and told them was an easy make. And who's he pick? He picks somebody new to the game, Natch. Somebody who doesn't even know where he lives. Doesn't even have his number. And he says, here, my man, you take this home and make yourself some money. You get anything good, I'll fence it for you. Beauvoir's eyes were wide. He wasn't smiling. Sound like anybody you know, man? Or maybe you try not to hang out with losers. You mean, he knew I was going to get killed if I plugged into that base? No, Bobby. But he knew it was a possibility if the package didn't work. What he mainly wanted was to watch you try. Which he didn't bother to do himself. Just put a couple of cowboys on it. It could have gone a couple different ways. Say if that icebreaker had done its number on the black ice. You'd have gotten in, found a bunch of figures that meant dick to you. You'd have gotten back out, maybe without leaving any trace at all. Well, you'd have come back to Leon's and told Two-A-Day that he fingered the wrong data. Oh, he'd have been real apologetic for sure. And you'd have gotten a new target and a new icebreaker. And he'd have taken the first one back to the sprawl and said it looked okay. Meanwhile, he'd have an eye cocked in your direction, just to monitor your health. Make sure nobody came looking for the icebreaker they might have heard you used. Another way it might have gone, the way it nearly did go. Something could have been funny with the icebreaker. The ice could have fried you dead. And one of those cowboys would have had to break into your mama's place and get that software back before anybody found your body. I don't know, Beauvoir, that's pretty fucking hard to... Hard my ass. Life is hard. I mean, we're talking biz, you know? Beauvoir regarded him with some severity. The plastic frames far down his slender nose. He was lighter than either Two-A-Day or the big man, the color of coffee with only a little whitener, his forehead high and smooth beneath close-cropped black frizz. He looked skinny under his gray sharkskin robe, and Bobby didn't really find him threatening at all. But our problem, the reason we're here, the reason you're here, is to figure out what did happen. And that's something else.
But you mean he set me up?
Two-A-Day set me up so I'd get my ass killed?
Bobby was still in the St. Mary's maternity wheelchair, although he no longer felt like he needed it.
And he's in deep shit with these guys, these heavies from the sprawl?
You got it now.
And that's why he's acting that way, like he doesn't give a shit,
Or maybe hates my guts, right? And he's real scared.
Beauvoir nodded.
And, Bobby said, suddenly seeing what Tuaday was really pissed about and why he was scared. It's because I got my ass jumped down by Big Playground, and those low fucks ripped me from my deck. And their software. It was still in my deck. He leaned forward, excited at having put it together. And these guys, it's like they'll kill him or something unless he gets it back for them, right?
I can tell you watch a lot of Kino, Beauvoir said. But that's about the size of it, definitely.
Right,
Bobby said, settling back in the wheelchair and putting his bare feet up on the edge of the table.
Well, Beauvoir, who are these guys? What you call them, Hoongans? Sorcerers, you said. What the fuck's that supposed to mean?
Well, Bobby, Beauvoir said, I'm one. And the big fella, you can call him Lucas. He's the other. You've probably seen one of these before, Beauvoir said, as the man he called Lucas put the projection tank down on the table, having methodically cleared a space for it.
In school, Bobby said. You go to school, man?
Tuaday snapped.
Why the fuck didn't you stay there?
He'd been chain-smoking since he came back with Lucas, and seemed in worse shape than he'd been in before.
Shut up, Tuaday, Beauvoir said. Little education might do you some good.
They used one to teach us our way around in the Matrix, how to access stuff from the print library like that.
Well then, Lucas said, straightening up and brushing non-existent dust from his big pink palms. Did you ever use it for that? To access print books?
He'd removed his immaculate black suit coat. His spotless white shirt was traversed by a pair of slender maroon suspenders. And he'd loosened the knot of his plain black tie.
I don't read too well, Bobby said. I mean, I can, but it's work. But yeah, I did. I looked at some real old books on the Matrix and stuff.
I thought you had,
Lucas said, jacking some kind of small deck into the console that formed the base of the tank.
Count zero. Count zero interrupt. Old programmer talk.
He passed the deck to Beauvoir, who began to tap commands into it. Complex, geometric forms began to click into place in the tank, aligned with the nearly invisible planes of a three-dimensional grid. Beauvoir was sketching in the cyberspace coordinates for Barrytown, Bobby saw.
We'll call you this Blue Pyramid, Bobby. There you are.
A blue pyramid began to pulse softly at the very center of the tank.
Now we'll show you what Tuaday's cowboys saw, the ones who are watching you. From now on, you're seeing a recording.
An interrupted line of blue light extruded from the pyramid, following a grid line. Bobby watched. Seeing himself alone in his mother's living room, the Ono Sendai on his lap, the curtains drawn, his fingers moving across the deck.
Icebreaker on its way,
Beauvoir said. The line of blue dots reached the wall of the tank. Beauvoir tapped the deck and the coordinates changed. A new set of geometrics replaced the first arrangement. Bobby recognized the cluster of orange rectangles centered in the grid.
That's it,
he said. The blue line progressed from the edge of the tank, headed for the orange base. Faint planes of ghost orange flickered around the rectangles, shifting and strobing as the line grew closer.
You can see something's wrong right there, Lucas said. That's their ice, and it was already hip to you. Rumbled you before you even got a lock.
As the line of blue dots touched the shifting orange plane, it was surrounded by a translucent orange tube of slightly greater diameter. The tube began to lengthen, traveling back along the line until it reached the wall of the tank.
Meanwhile, Beauvoir said, back home in Barrytown.
He tapped the deck again, and now Bobby's blue pyramid was in the center. Bobby watched as the orange tube emerged from the wall of the projection tank, still following the blue line, and smoothly approached the pyramid.
Now at this point, you are due to start doing some serious dying, cowboy.
The tube reached the pyramid. Triangular orange plane snapped up, walling it in. Beauvoir froze the projection.
Now, Lucas said, when Two-A-Day's hired help, who are all in all a pair of tough and experienced console jockeys, when they saw what you are about to see, my man, they decided that their deck was due for that big overhaul in the sky. Being pros, they had a backup deck. When they brought it online, they saw the same thing. It was at that point that they decided to phone their employer, Mr. Two-A-Day, who, as we can see from this mess, was about to throw himself a party.
Man,
Two-A-Day said, his voice tight with hysteria.
I told you. I had some clients up here needing entertaining. I paid those boys to watch. They were watching, and they phoned me. I phoned you. What the hell you want anyway?
Our property. Beauvoir said softly. Now watch this real close. This motherfucker is what we call an anomalous phenomenon, no shit. He tapped the deck again, starting the recording. Liquid flowers of milky white blossomed from the floor of the tank. Bobby, craning forward, saw that they seemed to consist of thousands of tiny spheres or bubbles, and then they aligned perfectly with the cubical grid and coalesced, forming a top-heavy, asymmetrical structure, a thing like a rectilinear mushroom. The surface's facets were white, perfectly blank. The image in the tank was no longer than Bobby's open hand, but to anyone jacked into a deck, it would have been enormous. The thing unfolded a pair of horns. These lengthened, curved, became pincers that arced out to grasp the pyramid. He saw the tip sink smoothly through the flickering orange planes of the enemy ice.
She said, "What are you doing?"
He heard himself say.
Then she asked me why they were doing that, doing it to me, killing me.
Ah, Beauvoir said quietly. Now we are getting somewhere.
He didn't know where they were going, but he was glad to be out of that chair. Beauvoir ducked to avoid a slanting grow light that dangled from twin lengths of curly cord. Bobby followed, almost slipping in a green-filmed puddle of water. Away from Two-A-Day's couch clearing, the air seemed thicker. There was a greenhouse smell of damp and growing things.
So that's how it was, Beauvoir said. Two-A-Day sent some friends round to Covina Concourse Courts, but you were gone. Your deck was gone, too.
Well, Bobby said, I don't see it's exactly his fault, then. I mean, if I hadn't split for Leon's, and I was looking for Two-A-Day, even looking to try to get up here, then he'd have found me, right?
Beauvoir paused to admire a leafy stand of flowering hemp, extending a thin brown forefinger to lightly brush the pale colorless flowers.
True, he said. But this is a business matter.
he should have detailed someone to watch your place for the duration of the run, to ensure that neither you nor the software took any unscheduled walks.
Well, he sent Rhea and Jackie over to Leon's because I saw him there.
Bobby reached into the neck of his black pajamas and scratched at the sealed wound that crossed his chest and stomach. Then he remembered the centipede thing Pi had used as a suture and quickly withdrew his hand. It itched. A straight line of itch. But he didn't want to touch it.
No, Jackie and Rhea are ours. Jackie is a mambo, a priestess, the horse of Danbala.
Beauvoir continued on his way, picking out what Bobby presumed was some existing track or path through the jumbled forest of hydroponics, although it seemed to progress in no particular direction. Some of the larger shrubs were rooted in bulbous, green plastic trash bags filled with dark humus. Many of these had burst, and pale roots sought fresh nourishment in the shadows between the grow lights, where time and the gradual fall of leaves conspired to produce a thin compost. Bobby wore a pair of black nylon thongs Jackie had found for him, but there was already damp earth between his toes.
A horse?
He asked Beauvoir, dodging past a prickly-looking thing that suggested an inside-out palm tree.
Danbala rides her. Danbala Wedu, the snake. Other times, she is the horse of Aida Wedu, his wife.
Bobby decided not to pursue it. He tried to change the subject.
How come Tuide's got such a mother huge place? What are all these trees and things for?
He knew that Jackie and Rhea had wheeled him through a doorway in the St. Mary's chair, but he hadn't seen a wall since. He also knew that the arcology covered X number of hectares, so that it was possible that Tuide's place was very large indeed. But it hardly seemed likely that a wereman, even a very sharp one, could afford this much space. Nobody could afford this much space. And why would anybody want to live in a leaky hydroponic forest? The last derm was wearing off, and his back and chest were beginning to burn and ache.
Ficus trees, mapu trees. This whole level of the projects is a lusan, holy place.
Beauvoir tapped Bobby on the shoulder and pointed out twisted, bicolored strings dangling from the limbs of a nearby tree.
The trees are consecrated to different loa. That one is for Ugu. Ugu Fere, God of War. There's a lot of other things grown up here. Herbs the leaf doctors need, and some just for fun.
But this isn't Tuide's place. This is communal.
You mean the whole project's into this? All like voodoo and stuff?
It was worse than Marsha's darkest fantasies.
No, man. And Beauvoir laughed. There's a mosque up top, and a couple of 10,000 Holy Roller Baptists scattered around. Some churches sigh. All the usual stuff, still. He grinned. We are the ones with the tradition of getting shit done. But how this got started, this level, that goes way back. The people who designed these places, maybe 80, 100 years ago, they had the idea they'd make them as self-sufficient as possible. Make them grow food. Make them heat themselves, generate power, whatever. Now this one, you drill far enough down, is sitting on top of a lot of geothermal water. It's real hot down there, but not hot enough to run an engine, so it wasn't going to give them any power. They made a stab at power up on the roof
with about 100 Darius Rotas, what they call egg beaters. Had themselves a wind farm, see? Today they get